You are listening to Gangland Wire, hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Hello, all you wiretappers out there. Coming here from the Gangland Wire studio. I am just fresh off my Kansas City Mafia Film Festival with my good friend Terrence O'Malley, who did the kind of overview of all Kansas City organized crime. Black Hand Straw Man. We showed my movie, Gangland Wire. We also showed my brand new movie, Brothers Against Brothers. That's the story of the Savella Sparrow Gang War in Kansas City in the 1970s. Now, don't forget to hit me up on Venmo. I had a request on Venmo from one of our fans, Mario Serignani. I hope I got that right, Mario. I know you don't pronounce the G mostly in Italian last names, but anyhow, and here's what he says. My wife makes me walk the dog every day. Your podcast provides a wonderful distraction and names and memories of the old days in my mom's kitchen near Belmont and Harlem. I believe that's Chicago. And he had a request, you know, he made a donation large enough on the Venmo app that he should get a Gangland Wire movie, which is what I usually mail that out. But he asked if he could get a Kindle version of the book. And so I looked into that, and yeah, I can do that. So if you want to make a donation of $25 or more and get a Kindle version of the book, I can send you a link for that thing. If you have Kindle, and you can just download to your computer the Kindle software from Amazon and read it on Kindle, which, if you remember, in my book, Leaving Vegas, if you want to hear the actual wiretaps, you just get that Kindle version. And each time I refer to the wiretap and have text from the wiretap, there's a link there that will take you right to the actual wiretap itself. So moving right along, the new movie is what I really want to talk about today. Brothers Against Brothers, the story of the Savella Sparrow War in Kansas City. You know, I worked this. I was on the street in one of my real early podcast episodes. I deal with this, and in the making of this movie, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the making of this movie. I stumbled onto a guy named Steve St. John that I actually worked a case on, and he's a local Kansas City guy and grew up over there around a lot of these guys, and so we started meeting for coffee, and we're still meeting for coffee or breakfast periodically, and he was a huge help in making that movie. He found, I told him I needed a stripper. I needed, in one scene, I needed to turn a club. I had the club, it's kind of a local sports bar that ran by a friend of mine, Kelly's, in Westport, and he donated the bar. He said we could use his bar, and I needed a stripper, and I had a couple other retired police women who would come in, but they wouldn't quite do the whole stripper thing that I wanted. I needed a scene where a stripper goes up to an undercover cop that's sitting at the bar and tries to get him to buy a lap dance, and he's all uncomfortable and won't do it, so she realizes, she figures out these two guys are cops, and she knows who they're probably watching, and that was Carl Sparrow, one of the participants in this gang war. So she goes over and tells Carl Sparrow, hey, these guys are following you, and tells everybody else in the bar. And it got a little bit uncomfortable for them. They went ahead and got out that day or that evening. And I tell another story in there about how since Carl Sparrow knew we were following him, and we were following him over to that strip club quite a little bit, and sometimes we'd go in, He got a hold of a guy who was actually an informant of mine who had a tow truck and said, hey, there's a tan Bronco out in the parking lot. Why don't you go lift that up and carry that off somewhere, and I'll take it off your hands later. And this guy, he didn't do it. He knew there was something wasn't quite right about that request. Turns out that was our tan Bronco. And so I go into a lot of details like that and a lot more details like that about the investigation and following Carl Sparrow around and trying to keep some of the Savella family from killing him and almost catching him in the act. And I've dealt with some of those things in different episodes, but in this movie I put it all together, and we got some really cool reenactment scenes that show a lot of that. Got some of the guys that worked on that. And I guess really one thing I want to go into for this will be is kind of an announcement of the movie Brothers Against Brothers. It's out there on Amazon. It's just like Gangland Wire. You can digitally download it for $1.99. And I have a request of you guys, as many of you as can. If I can get 1,000 of you to go in there and rent that thing for $1.99 the first week or so that it's out. Why, it will amp me way up in their algorithms and give it a lot more prominence, and they'll start notifying other people that, hey, there's a movie here that if you like this, then you'll like this other movie, and it'll help immensely. And I would appreciate that. That's a real easy way to support the podcast. And I'll make a little bit of money off that too, of course, but it's a real good way to support the podcast. It would help me much more than the $1.99 that you get to spend on the movie. And you'll get to see the movie and see my latest movie I hired this guy to help me with reenactment scenes, and I hired a professional narrator, and they did a great job. And I uncovered I'm going to tell you this story, but a lot more in depth than I do in the movie. I uncovered a whole situation that I had forgotten about back in those days. I was part of it, but somehow was not in the main part of it, so I kind of forgot about it. I was always on the periphery. And what we had done in 83, there was a guy named John Long who was a professional booster, and he was in jail for some heavy stuff. He needed big time help, and one of the guys in not my unit but a sister unit to ours called White Collar Crime went to the jail and talked to John and said, "Hey, you know, we can do something for you, but you got to do a lot of stuff for us because this is pretty heavy work that you, pretty heavy sentence that you're looking at here," whatever it was for. Now, it was probably just repeated theft. He probably had the three strikes thing against him, or the habitual. We had a habitual law in Missouri at the time, and he'd end up with some big time. John had gotten a little bit older, and he was not where he wanted to do all that time, and so he agreed that he would, and he was such a prolific booster and so well known that he knew all the mob guys who bought who were fences and then turned around and sold it out through their outlets and brokered different deals, these are all mob associates. None of them are made guys, but he could do those guys. But we had to have complete control of him, and we couldn't get anybody, the prosecutor or the judge, they would not just let him out without a huge bond, and we weren't going to post, you know, you'd have to get 10% up, and we weren't going to post like $50,000 to get him out on this $500,000 bond. It was really a high amount. They really did not want to let this guy out of jail. So we worked out an agreement. This had to take part at the upper management. It had to be the chief had to be involved with this as chief of police and probably the main elected prosecutor, because they had the charge on him here in Jackson County. They agreed. We promised, the police department promised, that he would be just like he was in jail. We would never let him out of our sight. But we could get him out of jail, and he could go out and work every day. And that's where I came in. Part of my job was I'd go over there like at 11 o'clock at night and take over from the p.m. shift, shall we say, the 3 to 11 or 4 to midnight. I can't remember the exact time. And I would work, say, midnight to 8. And then the day shift would start coming in at 8 o'clock. And this guy would just go in the other room and sleep, of course. And we were supposed to stay up all night. It was kind of hard to do. You'd drift off in and out. But he never snuck out on us. I'm sure that there was many times he probably could have. We'd sit around and play dominoes and cards and whatever we could think of all night long. We got a house donated to us by the command. Our commander had a brother who was a real estate agent. He donated us a house. And actually, they sold the first house out from under us, which was a pretty nice house, and moved him to a real crappy little house over in the middle of the ghetto. It was a dangerous neighborhood, and it was a crappy, cold, drafty, little old stinky house. But it was the best we could do. The first house was actually kind of nice. It was winter, I remember that, and we had one of those gas fireplaces, and we'd run that thing all night long. We did that about a week or two, I think about 2 weeks, and there was somebody running that thing all night long, and they got the first gas bill, and we had to shut the gas fireplace off after that. But, you know, I did stuff like I put my car in the garage and waxed it one night. You know, just try to find something to do to try to stay up and kill time all night long. Then in the morning, he'd go out, and we borrowed a state trooper named Tom Gray, who had been stationed somewhere else in the state and was not from Kansas City, so he was unknown. He was totally unknown in Kansas City. Brought him in, and he met up with John, and he would come by in the morning and pick John up, and then they'd go out, and what they were doing, they started out with reverse stinging, trying to get in with people. They would go out and buy, like, brand new clothes, and then take them to a couple of different bars where the bartender had connections to buy stuff and had new other people that he could turn around and sell stuff to, and there'd be mob-connected bars, which is how they got in with Carl Spiro. And then there was another fence named Junior Bradley that Big John had always dealt with for a long time, and he bought anything that you could buy out of a drugstore, for example. And he had a retail outlet down at the city market in which he'd sell his stuff. He would buy it for about 25 cents on the dollar, and they'd turn around and sell it for about 80% of the face value, whatever the tag was on it. They'd cut it by 20-25% and sell it out of the city market at Junior's place at the city market. Plus, he had a restaurant downtown. You know, he'd always have different stuff there to sell to regular customers. Junior Bradley was I've talked about him a long time ago. I really need to do a story on him. He was an interesting guy. He was just the nicest guy in the world. Everybody, you never met somebody that didn't like Junior Bradley. But he was totally connected with the Camposanos primarily. And he was half Italian himself and had been doing this kind of fencing activity since he was a young man. He had a small neighborhood store out what would have been the suburbs in the 50s, and he always had a back room that was filled with stuff, and all the people that came in there knew that, you know, if you needed something that was you wanted a good deal on it, didn't mind if it fell off the truck, shall we say, you'd go into Junior's and see if he had something like that. And if he didn't, he'd probably take an order and get it for you. So and he just had connections everywhere, because he was such a nice guy. So I went up on Junior, and John's going in and out of there. It was the first one. This was before Carl Spiro, and John's going in and out of there. And one of the early stories, and first got going, they put a Nagra tape recorder. That's a real high-end, sensitive, German-made tape recorder that's real thin. This is, you know, before the digitalization of everything today. Now you can get a great audio by just having his cell phone in his pocket. Turn it on the voice memo, but then we had to use something like this, and the daggone thing, they didn't want to tape it, because you want to tape it right up against the guy's body, and they just didn't, whoever did it this one time didn't do it very good, and it slipped out and started down his pant leg, and he could feel it going down his pant leg, and he's standing there talking to Junior with his state trooper standing next to him. They're just talking away, and Junior's real chatty. And they're just chatting away, and the thing gets down to his pant leg, down to the end, and Junior finally turns and does something else, and the guy just kind of like lifts up his foot just a little bit, and it slips on onto the floor, and then he had like size 12 feet, and he was a huge guy, and he just put his foot down on top of it. And by then, Junior turned around and started talking to them again, and they just had to keep talking until Junior turned away and long enough that Big John just reached down and swooped that thing up and stuck it in his pocket right away. And they walked out finally after that. So interesting. I remember we got up, they brought him a Freedom phone. This is a thing we used to do with these guys when you're trying to do it. They're called reverse sting like that, and you're just trying to get in with them. To see what other kind of criminal activity you can get. And you can get some dirty language recorded that indicates they know this is stolen property. That's not it's not the greatest case in the world, but you start getting in with them, you figure out some other things. And most of these fences figured out real quick with all these boosters were drug addicts, and they could make their money go a lot further by buying, at that time it was Dilaudid, and different kind, like oxycodone and oxycontin is a thing today. Back then, Percodan, I think, and Dilaudid were the drugs of the day for boosters. And So they started figuring out they could make their money go a lot farther if they would pay these boosters for the clothes with narcotics. And then they'd also end up, they'd be wanting even more narcotics so they could end up selling them narcotics also and kind of make money both ways. And eventually, Junior would start doing that, and after a long time, we finally took him down on that. They would bring him a Freedom Phone, what we called a Freedom Phone back then. It was a cordless phone that ran off of batteries, and it was tied to your regular, younger people won't even hardly remember these. It was tied to your landline, but it would, the signal would go from the base to your phone, so you could walk around your house and you weren't tied to your phone by a cord. And you could also overhear those really easily, the earliest ones especially, with a what we called a Bearcat scanner, just a scanner that you would buy at Radio Shack or any kind of a store like that, that would pick up all kinds of things, pick up all the police bands and all that low-frequency radio traffic. It would pick that up, so you would just get set to the frequency of the Freedom Phone. In the early days, they only had two frequencies, and we just set up across the street. You know, in Junior's, there was a bus station that we got up in the upstairs of it, and we just sit up there with the Bearcat scanner and listen to him talk to different people. He never really said too much dirty on it. I remember one thing, we knew this guy was coming in who had a load of something, but we didn't know what it was, and he was unknown before. So, you know, the guy with the up there with the scanner got hold of us, and we really needed to figure out who this guy was because they could tell it was important to Junior. Got the license number and saw him take a box of something in, like a case of something, couldn't tell what it was, and leave again real quick. And we finally took this down. We figured out what that was. It was a guy who worked on the dock of a company that had Polaroid film going through it. And Polaroid film, again, for younger people, Polaroid film was this film that's kind of expensive. And you would shoot it with a Polaroid camera, and then you could it develop right there in front of your eyes, and so you'd have your picture right away. And it was pretty expensive, and it was a small item that he could sell a lot of down there at the city market. And this guy, he had he was stealing it off the dock where he worked. And what was funny was the guy, he got, shall we say, the concession. We found out later he got the concession from another employee who had been doing that for years with Junior. And that guy left and was moving somewhere else. And so he sold the connection to Junior and the information on how to get these cases of film off the dock and in your car. And then got him introduced to Junior, who was a constant supply of money for that film. So that was kind of one of those interesting little tidbits you pick up. And we wouldn't have got onto that guy had we not known from the Bearcat scanner that whoever this was coming in. That might have just been some guy coming in. All of a sudden, you know, if you weren't like right on top of it at the time, you wouldn't even notice that he brought in some kind of a case of something into the store, because we weren't sitting on the store where you could see every person that came and went. Just people that were important, and so we got them close, and we had the informant going in, so we didn't want to burn the store. We didn't want Junior to think he was under constant surveillance. Then another thing they did, and that's where the Spiro and the Spiro movie came in. I found that state trooper still living in Kansas City, so I was able to interview him and put his story in there, at least kind of the bare bones of it. You can only put so much in one of these documentary films, and without like going clear down a whole nother path. And I was just dealing with the Spiro War. So it is 83. Three of the four Spiro brothers have been killed by the Civellas. The one that's left, Carl, he's in a wheelchair. He was crippled by a shotgun blast from the underboss, Carl Tuffy DeLuna. And he's been operating. He's bought a used car lot over here in the middle of the city, kind of in what I would say mob territory on the northeast side, close to Columbus Park, and Little Italy, as we used to call it. And he's operating out there. And I remember we never really saw, there's two or three used cars sitting on the lot, but you never really saw any customers coming and going. He had a little shack there where you could go and look at a car and then go in the shack and try to make a deal. But you never really saw that. We'd see some of his other criminal associates coming and going out of there, but not really no customers. And so Tom Gray, the undercover highway patrol, and Big John go into the Virginia Tavern, which is the kind of the hangout where the Spiros hung out. We're real close with the owner and bartender, a guy named Frankie Todaro. This is a place where they had the Zabella crew, three Basque men, burst in and killed Mike Spiro and wounded Joe Spiro and crippled Carl with the shotgun blast. So this has always been, you know, Spiro headquarters, as far as the bar's concerned. And Big John and Tom go in there, and they're drinking and talking with Frankie Todaro, the owner and bartender, and they had a woman's coat, a brand new woman's coat. And I said, hey, you want this? You know, we boosted this and used a little money or traded out for some beer here. He said, no. I said, I don't really want that. He said, Carl over there might, and Carl Spiro was sitting over the table in his wheelchair. So John goes over, and John kind of knows him. They know each other by reputation for sure. He sells him the coat. So Carl says, well, you guys, you're working now, huh? And John says, yeah, we are. You need something? He said, yeah. And he gave him a whole list of stuff that he wanted. And of course, the next day or two, they went out and bought it. And they then met Carl down his car lot. And they just started going in and out of this car lot, bringing him some stolen property, seeing if he wanted it. Just, you know, shooting the breeze and talking with some of his other members of his little gang, a guy named Frankie Angotti and a guy named Kuzi and a couple other young guys, and I don't even remember who they were, just kind of hangers-on. Probably Tony Cerrone, who was actually an ex-policeman and got in trouble and got fired. And as Tom said, you know, he said, the whole time we were going in and out there, I never saw him sell a car. I never heard him even talk about selling a car. Maybe he sold a car, I don't know, but I sure never saw it. They frequented that, and it wasn't long since they knew Big John was a drug addict. And he really was in recovery, shall we say, at the time, probably forced recovery by us because we were monitoring him 24 hours a day. He didn't. I remember one time he was mad. He got up, and I don't know if any of you guys, you know, when you first quit smoking, you're mad. You first quit drinking, you're mad. You first quit any kind of a habit, you're really mad because you can't get what you want. And I remember he got up one day, and I happened to work days that day for some reason. It seemed like I usually work dog watch, midnight to 8, but I was working days. And John, he was mad. He was railing around and bitching about the investigation. They didn't really have anything for him to do that day. Tom had to go catch up on reports or whatever. And finally he said, take me to the chiropractor. So we called the chiropractor, it was close by, and I took him to the chiropractor. And it was just me and him. Like I said, this like 6'5", 275-pound guy and me, who was about 5'9", about 160 pounds then. And I get him to the chiropractor, and he goes in, and he comes back out after that adjustment, and he's like a different guy. He's like the guy he was before, just kind of funny and telling jokes and stories and stuff, and take him back to the safe house and sit with him all day till, gratefully, the next shift came in, and I was able to get out of there. It was a long, boring day, long, boring night doing this. But we had to keep him under wraps and had to keep him under control. In the end, his wife got mad at him, and as they got close to the end, she had been out of town, she came back to town, and she knew what he was doing. And in the end, she started hitting the bars and getting drunk over here in Northeast, which is this area close to Little Italy, or there wasn't really any bars anymore in Little Italy, but it was where people that all these kind of semi-professional or professional criminals would hang out, and people that grew up in the neighborhood and people that knew people that were part of the mob, they were in these bars, and she started telling people that John was doing this with an undercover agent or some other snitch, but she said he was snitching. And it was, the word was just starting to get out, and they didn't even know it yet themselves. It would all come down in a little bit. They started buying drugs from and trading stolen property with a doctor, Dr. Masasi. He was an osteopath, I believe, up North River, and that was Carl Spiro's connection to get drugs, and he started paying him in drugs, and And pretty soon they started buying drugs from him. They made a case on Musasi, and then they kind of backed off from him. Spiro didn't really know that they were dealing with Musasi, and they had a case on Musasi, and they backed off and they started pushing Carl, and so they started meeting Carl and getting drugs from him, and actually they bought Tom says a .357 Magnum pistol from him, and so they had some really good cases on this Carl Spiro, and it was just getting ready to come down, but the word was starting to leak out on the street, and they were on their way to the car lot one day, and as they got there. They always carried a police radio, a walkie-talkie. They just turned off and throw in the trunk or hide somewhere underneath the seat or probably up in the trunk. And they got a call just about the time they got to use car lot, and they said, you know, don't go down there. Something bad's happened. And they didn't tell them anymore, and they went back to the safe house. And when they got back to the safe house, they found out that when Carl had arrived that morning and walked into his little shack, he wasn't in there very long, and he got on the phone, was talking to somebody. They said it was one of his dead brother's wives, and a huge bomb went off. It was so bad, it blew him and his wheelchair out through the roof of this shack and deposited him out in the parking lot, and just the shack was like no more. I was talking to a friend of mine who was a bomb scene disposal or bomb disposal guy, and he and ATF were down there and looking through all the debris, and he looked down, he saw something rolled, looked like it was rolled up, it was funny looking, and he picked it up, see what it was, and as he unrolled it, he realized this was a piece of skin with a tattoo on it, so that was part of Carl's skin laying there with a tattoo on it. It just blew the dog shit out of him. You could see his body in a picture underneath in a body bag being taken out, but it was pretty bad. And the last bomb that they had tried to put on him up at his house, and his nephew, I go into this in the movie too, his nephew found it. It had 29 sticks of dynamite, and the nephew found it, and they were able to call the county sheriff up there, who called Kansas City's bomb disposal unit and ATF, and they came up and hit it with a water cannon and then took it apart. So, and then another friend of Carl Sparrow's, not too long before that, who was a good, close, well-to-do, rich guy who liked to hang out with mobsters, connection and friend of his, he found a bomb next to his car, and it had about 30 sticks of dynamite for it. So, and this one here, it must have had, it was overkill just like that other one. They didn't need that much dynamite to kill him. If you don't need to blow a guy clear up out of the roof of the shack and deposit him and his wheelchair out in the parking lot to kill him. So that's all in the new movie. And if you would all hit Amazon and rent the thing, Brothers Against Brothers, the Svela-Spiro War, you would be an immense help to me and to this podcast, and we'd get some money to keep this podcast going and support it and make it a little easier for myself and Cam. We can amp up our stuff a little bit, our game a little bit, and also help continue to sell that movie and that really nice little piece of Kansas City history. Oh, and by the way, when you watch that movie, you'll see that I'm in it quite a little bit. We did a little bit different technique. I had not done this before. I never put myself in the last movie I did. I did a couple others, about Civil War stuff here in this area. But in the last one I did, I was part of the investigation, but I didn't put myself in it at all. Well, in this one, I was one of the surveillance team, and it was a lot about the surveillance and trying to keep the Spiros from being killed and keep them from killing one of the Svelas, and it was really all about that. So one of the guys that helped me, I hired this professional to help me with it, and he said, you ought to put yourself in it. And we did a bunch of interviews of me and one of the other guys that worked on that, and Tom Gray, the undercover. And we did them out on the streets because that's where we live this story, on the streets and in the northeast area of Kansas City. So we just did the interviews out in the exact places where we did it. It starts off with me standing in front of the local mafia social club called The Trap, or the Northview Social Club, or Columbus Park Social Club. It had a variety of names. But it starts off there, and there was some activity that happened around there. So we go where we're talking about the things that happen. You're going to see me standing there, or me in a car, or Bobby Arnold in a car, telling about how he was after a mob guy one night, just trying to follow him, and got burnt and almost got himself killed. So it's a pretty exciting movie. I'm proud of it. And if you just hit that at Amazon.com, you're probably, if you search Brothers Against Brothers and Gary Jenkins, you'll probably find it. Or Brothers Against Brothers, the Savella Spiro War, Gary Jenkins, you'll find it. So I appreciate it. And as usual, if you have a friend or relative that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. That's my public service announcement, and I won't even, Kansas City Mob Tour app. I'm working real hard to get this on Google. I'm going to make another run at them. I can't even explain why it's not on there. I'm going to make another run at that. So get that Kansas City Mob Tour app. You can see some of these places from, if you're in Chicago or New York or L.A. or Dallas or wherever you are, you can still see some of these places and see pictures of some of these people that I've talked about. So good evening, folks.
Music provided by our good friend and super fan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.